Hebrews chapter 11. We are in our series in the book of Hebrews that we've been looking at the book of Hebrews, and this idea that Jesus is greater than what has come before, that God in the past spoke to the fathers through the prophets in many portions and in many ways, but in these last days has spoken in a Son whom he's appointed as heir of all things, through whom he made the universe and upholds all things by the word of his power. That's Hebrews chapter 1:1-2. But this idea that in the past God has done many things through like angels and Moses and Aaron and high priests and sacrifices, but in these last days God has fulfilled those things. And whatever it was that was mediating that relationship between God and his people in the past, Jesus is greater than any mediator that has either come down out of heaven or has been raised up out of human beings. Jesus is greater. That is the message of the book of Hebrews. And as we get into this chapter 11, there is this thing, there is this journey that we are on to the city of God. And the journey to the city of God, Hebrews has three movements: the movement into the rest of God, the movement into the holy place, and the movement to the city of God. And in this particular part of the book of Hebrews, we are journeying to the city of God. We've never seen it. We've never been there. But God has prepared it. He has prepared a place for his faithful, the people of God, and they are on a journey to get there. And the thing about this journey is that it takes a lot of endurance to make that journey, and it takes some courage to make that journey as well. It is not the easiest journey to make. But we also find that there are beautiful, faithful people from the past that have been on this journey all these days. And the author of Hebrews is going to talk about these people that have been on that journey, and the way they have made that journey is by faith. And we have this chapter 11 in which this what we call the hall of faith, or the so-called hall of faith, that talks about these examples of faith, these heroes of faith. And what we're going to be talking about, what we have been talking about, is that one of the cool things about this chapter is that the author of Hebrews wants to let us know that what a experience of faith looks like. And what we've been noticing in here is that as many people that are in here, we have these unique experiences of faith. We do not all have the same experience of faith. We've all encountered God in ways that are unique to us. I think that there's something beautiful about that, that God would look down at you and particularize you and say, hey, what Steve needs is this, and I'm going to give that to him. But that's different than what the other Steve needs, right? Or that's different than what Lee needs. It's that God would look down and that he would give us these unique experiences of faith. And what we've seen is that these experiences of faith that we see in the book of Hebrews in chapter 11, that there's no uniform experience. Abel suffered and died because of his faith uniquely. Whereas Enoch, his contemporary, did not suffer and die because of his faith. Both of them exhibited faith, but both had a very different experience of faith. Noah saved himself and his family because of faith. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, who we heard about last week, all had distinct stories and experiences of how they encountered God and how they dealt with how God was working in their lives. Now, what unites all of these experiences, their experiences of faith, as well as our experiences of faith, according to the writer of Hebrews, in Hebrews 11:1, he says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. And what we talked about last week and the week before is that faith is, and this is the way that I'm describing it and we're kind of walking through it, is that faith is essentially trust in the face of invisibility. That when God and his promises in this world seem obscured, or when God and his promises in this world are hard to see, or when God and his promises in this world are simply not seen by us, that is when we exhibit our faith. It's trust. The way we respond to God's invisibility, the way we respond to God's being hard to get, the way we respond that I don't see all these promises coming to bear in my lifetime, the way we respond to that is what we call faith. And this chapter catalogs what the faithful have done for generations in response to the fact that God is hard to get sometimes. I mean, can I get an amen? God is a little bit hard. God's a little bit hard to be around sometimes. Like he's a little mysterious sometimes. Sometimes I don't always understand what he's doing. Sometimes he promises something and I cannot see it coming to bear in my life. And that is the experience of faith. Now, the author of Hebrews is going to talk about a reward and a payout, but in order to get to that, again, it takes some endurance and some courage. And we're going to see one example of that today, and that is the example of Moses and the experience of faith of Moses. So Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 23 is where we're going to start with Moses. Let's look at this together. It says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Now, the story of Moses begins in Exodus chapter 2. Hebrews is recalling what's happening in Exodus chapter 2, and many of you know this story. I think the cool thing about this story is even though Moses is the subject of the story in Hebrews, it's not his faith that is original to Moses. It's his parents. Exodus 2:1 says this, now a man from the house of Levi went and took his wife, as his wife, a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. And so this idea that Moses has parents that were faithful, it was their faith. Now, in the Old Testament, it particularly says, no offense to the guys here, but it particularly says that the mother was the one that was faithful. Hebrews says that his parents hid him for 3 months. Now, part of this is that a three-month hiding is a three-month resistance and defying of the king's edict. And so part of this is about the endurance and the conviction of these parents to hide this baby for 3 months. Now, if you remember the story in the Old Testament, all the Hebrew children, all the Hebrew male children, the Hebrew female children could be born and they could thrive, et cetera, et cetera. But because there were so many Hebrews that were being born in Egypt, that the king made the edict that all the male children needed to be killed or thrown into the Nile River. Now, mom here is like, that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. Her faith leads her to some sort of resistance to the edict. Now it says here that it says in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw the child was beautiful. Now there's a lot of different translations for this. It's not the kind of normal word for beautiful. It actually has this idea behind that basically they looked at the child and they were like, this is no ordinary child. And I don't know what it was that, I don't know what Moses looked like or what it was, what happened, but, or whether this was just the love of a mother who carried a child for 9 months. But when they looked at the child, the mother and the father, they were like, this is not an ordinary child. There was something about him. He showed marks of refinement and breeding. It's an unusual word, and when the author of Exodus, as well as the author of Hebrews, uses this word, it kind of gives this idea that the people of Israel, the Hebrews, are in slavery under Pharaoh, but there's something about this child that is going to be a match for Pharaoh. And they saw it at birth, and so by faith, they disobeyed the king's edict. And by faith, they hid the child. And even eventually, by faith, what happens when they could no longer hide, a baby, like that's going to happen, and they had to put it into the Nile River, it says this in the book of Exodus, when she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes or reeds and daubed it with bitumen and pitch, and she put this child and placed him among the reeds in the riverbank. So she obeyed the king's edict. She just provided a boat for the child. And she didn't just toss the child in the Nile. She put the boat where Pharaoh's daughter was going to come down. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river. While her young women walked beside the river, she saw a basket among the reeds and sent a servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child. Behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." So Pharaoh's daughter knew this is one of the baby boys that is being put to death. But she had pity on him. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said, "Yeah, go." So the girl called the child's mother. What a great deal, right? They worked it by faith. They defied the edict and worked it so mom could nurse the child and get paid for it, it says. Pharaoh's daughter said, "Take this child away and nurse him for me. I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him, knowing that God had a plan for this child, by faith. She didn't know what it was. It's invisible. The plan is invisible. But she knew by faith. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, "I drew him out of the water." So the child was beautiful. They were not afraid. I think what's interesting is it says in Hebrews that they were not afraid of the edict of the king. And this is one of the things that sometimes in culture we're called to an act of civil disobedience, or we're called to an act of resistance. I think in our day and age, sometimes that's happening everywhere. Everybody feels like, I have to have an act of civil disobedience for everything. I don't want to wear a mask. I don't want to not meet together. I mean, if I preached the sermon during COVID, like, we would have riots, right? Acts of civil disobedience or whatever, like protests. And there's plenty of protests. May 1st is the National Day of Protest. Like, if you have a grievance, it's like the airing of grievances at the Festivus Festival, right? It's the May 1st. So there's plenty of that, and there's plenty of that. But I think what the idea here is that this act of disobedience was an acknowledgement that God had a different plan. It was not simply, "I don't want to do it." It was that God has a plan. And so I will resist, and I will not be afraid of the edict of the king. I like Moses' mom. I like her. She's got chutzpah, right? This is what Israeli bus drivers have. They got a lot of nerve, right? She's got that. And she's not afraid of the edict of the king. Because essentially, she can see something that no one else can see. She saw that the child was special and specially called by God. She saw something that no one else saw. And she acted on it. And that's faith. Trust in the face of invisibility. It's action in the face of not knowing what is coming. So that's mom. That's the Mother's Day. That's Mother's Day sermon. I should have saved that one for Mother's Day, right? But here's where we go. Look at 11:24. So now we talk about Moses. By faith, Moses did not just ride on the faith of his parents. When he was grown up, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. And I suppose that this is maybe one of the first things that we want to note about the nature of faith. You cannot simply be born into faith and that be it. I remember growing up and coming to faith, just because you are in a McDonald's, it doesn't make you a hamburger, right? Just because you're in a garage, it doesn't make you a car. Just because you're in a church, it doesn't mean that you have put your faith in Jesus, right? And so there is this sense, and this is our tradition, the Evangelical Free Church, that one of the values of the Evangelical Free Church and evangelicalism as a whole is this idea of personal faith, owning your faith for yourself. Yes, Moses' mom must have been awesome and had great faith and sang the songs and told the stories, but ultimately it was when Moses grew up, he had to express his own faith. And for a lot of us in here, like we might still be in process on that, about this idea that, yes, this is my parents' faith or my parents' church, but at some point there's a point where we make it our own faith. And that's a call of faith. You cannot borrow someone else's faith. Now, there are examples in Scripture where someone else's faith does affect us. I love the story of the guys who dropped in Mark chapter 2, where Jesus is teaching in this room, and there's no way to get in. They bring this guy on a stretcher, but there's no way to get him in, so they dig a hole in the roof and they drop him down. I think one of the most cool things about that story is that Jesus, when it's not that he looks at the paralytic on the mat and sees his faith, he looks up at the four guys who dug a hole in the roof and he sees their faith. And because of their faith, he heals that guy. That's a beautiful story too. And I think there's some mystery to this idea of the faith of our fathers and mothers and how that comes to bear on our own faith, but ultimately we have to land in our own personal faith. God knows you, loves you. He might love your family too, but he's looking at you. He has you in mind. He sees you. And he wants to see your response to him. That's faith. So, anyway, when Moses was grown up, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. So, when he is born, his parents exhibit faith. And after he grows up, he exhibits faith. It says he refused to be called he refused to be called a daughter. That's another sermon. He refused to be called the son. Sorry, everybody. I'm really loose up here today. Okay, hang on. A little water. We'll wrap it in here. All right. He refused to be called a son of the daughter of Pharaoh. Now here, the Old Testament says that Moses was raised as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, for me growing up, I didn't think much about that, except that there's a lot of traditions about Moses in the Jewish world and in the first century that had the idea that Moses was heir to the throne of Pharaoh because he was the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Now, the Bible doesn't say that. Philo and Josephus in the first century, they both imply that. But ultimately, the idea is that whether or not he's going to inherit the throne, and I don't think that's what the case was, but Moses, by being in this royal household, was certainly going to inherit a princely lifestyle in Egypt. He was going to not want for anything, and he was going to have whatever he desired, essentially. And so but it also says that he refused to be called the son of the daughter of Pharaoh. And that word refused is essentially the word that he denied that, or he renounced being called the son of the daughter of Pharaoh. So he had this status. He's in this family, even though he's Hebrew, and he might have stayed connected with his mom and dad and his sister. Obviously, he stays connected with his sister Miriam and Aaron. He stays connected with his family. But ultimately, he is known as the son of the daughter of Pharaoh, the Pharaoh's grandson, and all the things that come with that. And what Hebrews says is that by faith, Moses decided to renounce that status. He chose to renounce what essentially would get him comfort and would essentially have that he would not want for anything, and he chose instead to be mistreated with the people of God. Moses in some way renounced. We don't know exactly what Egypt was like. There's a few things that we can know about it. It was not, but it was known as a stable economy. It was known for its wealth. It talks about the treasures of Egypt. They were legendary, the treasures of Egypt, the storehouses of Egypt, particularly its grain, because it was able to produce so much grain in the ancient world. It made it a very wealthy area. It made it a very stable area. When famines hit, people would go to Egypt. And so Egypt was a breadbasket, a place where you could ride out the storm in Egypt, and the people who controlled Egypt and the Nile River certainly benefited from all that. And Moses was right in that gravy train. He wanted for nothing. But he renounced that. It says, choosing to be mistreated with the people of God, choosing to be identified with God's people, rather than the transitory enjoyment of sin. Now, it doesn't exactly say what this could be, but in Egypt, this would be food. This would be sex. This would be gluttony. This would be having servants at your beck and call, slaves. Comfort. Probably a lot of that coming at the hands of injustice. You see how slaves are treated in that culture. And Moses would have had access to all of those things. I think what's interesting is that Moses chose to identify with the people of God rather than to enjoy his privilege. I think it's an interesting story. It's a story of faith. It's also the story of Jesus, right? Jesus, who being in the very form of God, did not consider equality with God something to be held on to, but emptied himself. That's Philippians chapter 2. That's the story of the book of Hebrews, that he's not ashamed to call you brothers and sisters, that he had to be made like his brothers and sisters in every way so that he could become a merciful and faithful high priest. That's the story of Jesus. He did not leverage his position, but he chose self-emptying, and that is what Moses essentially does. I think it's interesting. We're kind of in a time in Christianity where there's a number of people who maybe they've been hurt by the church, or the church is, look, church is a strange place. I don't need to tell you guys that. You're all here. Right? Right? Church can be a weird place, and a lot of things can go weird at church. And because of that, a lot of people will say, I love Jesus, but I don't want the church. Right? I love my personal faith in Jesus. I just talked about we got to have our personal faith in Jesus. But that whole church thing, I'm fine sitting this one out. And what I want to point out about Moses is that for Moses, and I think for God as well, and for Jesus, faith has to be individual, it cannot remain alone. There's no example of faith that we have here that is a total lone ranger. It's always identification with the people of God. Jesus identifies with you all, not ashamed to call you brothers and sisters. Moses chooses not to keep his position, but to identify with the people of God. And I just want to say this, and this might, you know, you're here, so I'm kind of preaching to the choir in some ways, but the idea that I can love Jesus and not identify with God's people in a community is something foreign to the history of Christianity. That there's always an identification with the people. That's one of the things that we see in the book of Hebrews, that because there was so much persecution going on, that people were being publicly ridiculed or thrown in jail, or that they were being partnered with people who were being ridiculed, that a lot of people were just like, hey, I'm not going to, like, you guys do your thing over here. I'm just going to kind of stay over here. I'm not going to identify with you. And that's why the author of Hebrews says, do not give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but encourage each other all the more, even as you see the day approaching. That the call of faith is definitely, especially with Moses, you've got to come to your own faith. But at the same time, when you do come to your own faith, there is a robust community that God is calling you into. And again, the church can be crazy. And there's plenty of podcasts, and there's plenty of people. And we've all maybe experienced where a church has gone wrong at a certain point. Whether it's a church you came from, or whether it's this church, or whether it's another church. The church can go wrong. That is true. Our role is to reform. If the church has gone wrong, our role is not to abandon. Our role is to reform, to heal, and to move forward in the name of Jesus, because the church is the bride of Christ. And we do not abandon the bride of Christ. All right? So, and I know you guys are all here and you love each other, and that's wonderful. And I see it whenever we greet each other. Like, it's beautiful to see that. And when church goes right, it is absolutely beautiful. And when church goes wrong, Oh, it grieves our hearts. The reason why we're so pumped when it goes well and we're so grieved when it goes wrong is because of how important it is to identify with the people of God. So we see the value of it, and Moses saw the value of it, not to keep his position, but to identify with the people of God. Jesus saw the value of it, not to keep his position, but to identify with the people of God, and to take whatever reproach came with that. And that's what the author of Hebrews wants to encourage his people to do. Regardless of what's happening in this world, identify with the people of God. It might be hard for a time, but there is great reward in that. All right, let's keep going. Let's keep going. All right. 11:26. Moses also has to make, so Moses has the faith of his family, but he also has to come to his own faith and identify with God's people. But ultimately, Moses has to do what all of us have to do, and that is to make a calculation about what our faith costs us. What's the value of our faith, and what does our faith cost us? Look at 11:26. He considered the reproach of Christ greater than the wealth, He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. Now, it's the reproach of Christ, there's a lot of questions about how did Moses know about the reproach that Jesus would experience. There's a lot of ideas about that. It does say in chapter 3 that Moses was a steward over the house of God and that he was testifying about the things that would come. And there are some things that Moses will say, like in Exodus and Deuteronomy, that are precursors to what the Messiah Jesus is going to do. But ultimately, Moses essentially, he makes a calculation about, do I take on reproach? What sort of reproach should I take on in light of the reward that is to come? Or do I take on the reward presently, knowing that it might cost me in the future? It's a calculation that every one of us makes in here as regard to our faith. Living in the world, we ask the question, what do we engage in this world in light of the reward that I want to have at the end of my life? What do I do and believe now in light of where I want to be and what I want to become? And it's a calculation that he has to make. And he considered the reproach of Messiah Christ, Jesus, greater wealth than the treasures, than the legendary treasures of Egypt. Over here, the legendary treasures of Egypt. And over here, the reproach of God's people. Which will you choose? And this is a calculation, because faith is not simply about what is seen, right? It's about what is unseen in the future, the promises that are to come. And Moses has to make this calculation, and we also make the same calculation on a day-to-day basis for many of us. Many of us make decisions that we've decided about that long ago, and that's put us in a particular place, in a particular marriage, in a particular posture in this world, and we've decided already. And a lot of times that posture helps us as we continue to decide daily. But no doubt there are things that come across our phones and our TV screens and our computers that we have to make decisions about, or how we engage in this world, we have to make a decision about how am I going to engage in that in light of my faith. And there are things that can make my life easier or better, and the question is, do I choose those things in light of my faith? It's a calculation that every person of faith has to make. For Moses, and this is where his eyes, he looks at the treasures of Egypt, and he looks at the reproach of this world. And if you're just in this world, you're just looking at those two things, the treasures of Egypt and the reproach. But what Moses was looking to was neither of those things. He was looking to the reward. He saw these things for what they are. They are momentary and transitory, but the reward is eternal. The reward is forever. The reward is greater. And if I choose this, I get the reward. But if I choose this, I might forfeit the reward. Moses is now looking for the payoff. The author of Hebrews says in 10:35, he uses the same word, "Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has great reward." In Hebrews, it talks about those who earnestly seek God, God becomes a rewarder. And now Moses is looking to that payoff. And this is the thing about faith. Oftentimes, in faith, in our world, we do not receive the payoff, the reward, in this world. What we receive is reproach, or opposition, or persecution for our faith. Sometimes we get rewarded for our faith. I'm not saying that that doesn't happen. Like, sometimes we get a good reputation in the community because we're people of faith. But sometimes when we put our foot down for our faith, there's scandal, or there's reproach, or there's, you get cut out, you get overlooked on the promotion, or whatever it is. Looking to the reward is where Moses was looking. And ultimately, look at 11:27. Moses seems to find a way to train his eyes to see things that no one else can see. 11:27, by faith he left Egypt. It says that he abandoned Egypt. Like Egypt was a sinking ship that he needed to swim away from. Some of the early church fathers talked about this world. Like this world, the world we live in is like a sinking ship that we should just abandon ship and get the heck out of. I don't know if you ever thought about that before. And what is our posture in this world? Look, maybe we want to fix the boat and keep it going, but sometimes we just, like Moses was like, Egypt, whatever Egypt is, abandon ship. Get the heck out of there. He abandoned it. By faith, he abandoned Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. I don't even understand that. Moses sees him who is invisible. Again, he sees, right? How do you do this? How do you do this? And this is the idea that people of faith, look, Moses' mom and dad, when they looked at the baby, what did they do? They saw something that no one else could see. When Moses is looking for the reward, he's looking for the thing that is unseen. And eventually, why is he able to endure? Why is he able to stand up in front of Pharaoh? Why is he able to do all of these things? Why is he able to lead these people out? Why is he able to withstand even the criticisms from his own people during this time? How is he able to withstand, I mean, just the messenger of such severity, of plague after plague after plague to death. That's all, how is he able to do that? And the thing is, what it says in Hebrews is that he is able to see, he endured because he saw the invisible. He saw the unseen. I think this is essentially the call of faith. This is what you might come to faith as a young person, and you might get used to this, but over time, I think this idea, as we mature in our faith, we begin to have eyes that see things in light of what God is doing invisibly. Maybe you've experienced this before, circumstances in your life, and everybody else looks at them and they're like, well, that's horrible, or how can you even love God? But you see something beyond that. And your eyes can see that God is at work in this somehow. You don't know how you know. You don't know how you see. But somehow you can see beyond what is invisible to everyone else. And Moses and the people of faith in Hebrews chapter 11, and I think what the author of Hebrews is trying to say, is that look, as you exercise your faith, you are going to begin to train your senses to discern where God is at work. Where everyone else looks and they just see nothing, you see God at work. How is Moses able to do that? He is able, his eyes have been trained over time to see the things that are invisible. And so trust in the face of invisibility becomes something that his eyes begin to see. I think, again, sometimes God is invisible in this world. Sometimes God, maybe it's not that God is invisible, but sometimes God is just fuzzy or unclear. Maybe you're like kind of in the middle of, I feel like someone's getting a lot of texts right now. but I'm going to get back on track here. Sometimes it's not just that God is invisible, because if you've had faith, it's not, you have a sense that he's there, but it's just, I don't know where he's at. It's fuzzy. I'm in the valley of this of deep darkness. I don't know where he's at. I know he's there because I believe, I have faith, but I don't know where he's going. That I think sometimes our experience of faith is not just that God, maybe he's not invisible, but he's just obtuse or obscure or fuzzy, unclear. Or maybe just in our lives that God sometimes is just hidden. I know he's there, but he's hiding behind a bush or something. I don't know. I know he's here. I don't know where he's at. And look, if you're in that situation, that is an experience of faith. Even the question of like, God, where are you? I know you're there. That's faith. I don't know where you are. That's faith too. As we continue in faith, we begin to train our eyes to see what is unseen. And we have to imagine that the further we get in faith, the more we exercise that muscle, the stronger it gets. And so sometimes we might think like, oh, I don't have the faith to do that. It's like, look, it's kind of like when I ran this race last weekend, the Ragnar race. I know everything. Kelly's like, now everything used to be Half Dome. Now it's Ragnar. Okay. But look, when I started running, I hadn't run in like a decade. I know you look at me, you're like, Craig, you look super fit. I'm sure you say that. But like when I started in September, it was like I jog a tenth of a mile, I walk a tenth of a mile. Then I jog a tenth of a mile and I walk a tenth of a mile. Like my mile time was like 14 minutes. That's not good, everybody, okay? Like it's a very slow time. And then the next day I would try to go a little bit longer. Maybe a quarter mile, run a quarter mile, walk a quarter mile, run a quarter mile, walk a quarter mile, until eventually, I didn't do a ton of training, but I was up to 8 miles by the end of my training. I could run 8 miles without stopping. Like there's other guys on this that were these pastors, and they're like animals. They're like running 20 miles in a week and all this stuff. But all that to say, God is not going to say, "I need you to run a marathon with no training." He's going to say, "Look, I know you have faith. I know you have a little bit of faith, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to run a tenth of a mile, and then I'm going to walk with you for a tenth of a mile. You're not going to be able to see me for a tenth of a mile, and then I'm going to walk with you for a tenth of a mile, and you're going to know I'm there." And there might be longer and longer periods where you're able to run where you don't know where I am. But because you've been training your eyes to see the things that are invisible, you know I'm there. And there might be a day where I call you to run a really long and hard race. And I'm going to need you to trust me. And I know you'll be able to because I've trained you along the way. What child whom his father loves does not train them up? That's chapter 12 in Hebrews. And that is exactly what God is doing in Hebrews. He's training them. And he's training us in the various events of our lives where we're like, I don't know where God is. And God's like, I know you don't know where I am. Hang on, I'm going to show up here in a little bit and I'm going to walk with you. You're going to know I'm with you. And there might be another time where I need you to walk in such a way that you cannot see me. But I need you to know, even though you walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you fear no evil. I am with you. Moses was able to do that because he had trained his eyes to see the things that are unseen, and that's faith. Trust in the face of invisibility. I'm going to ask the worship team to come back up. But as they do, I just want us to reflect. Is there a place where God, particularly today, seems a little invisible to you? And maybe it is, maybe it even goes back to the idea, like, I don't even know, like, I don't have the faith of my family of origin. Like, Moses is awesome because he's got this mom who had all this chutzpah and a lot of faith and whatnot. I don't have that. Maybe that's your story, and maybe you have to look elsewhere for examples of faith, but they're out there. God is going to give you eyes to see these examples of faith, and maybe there's events in your life that you don't know what's going on and how God is using them, and this is an opportunity to simply say, hey, I'm going to trust, and maybe even today, the way I'm going to trust is I'm just going to grab somebody before I leave, and I'm just going to say, hey, would you pray for me? Look, you don't even have to say, like, we've got so many people in here that are like, if you just say, hey, will you pray for me? They'll just, like, jump right in, and they will pray for you. They don't need to know anything that's going on in your life, but they will pray that God will reveal himself to you. They'll pray you up. But maybe your act of faith today is simply to grab someone and say, hey, just pray for me really quickly. Just 30 seconds, just pray for me. We all know, look, we all live in this world. We all live in this world where it's invisible, everybody. And your pastor's not immune to that either. We all have to trust in the face of invisibility. We do it as a community. And there might be days where someone's super strong and someone's super weak. And that's because they need to get together and they need to support each other. The strong supports the weak, because one day that might shift. And the person who is strong one day becomes weak, and the person who's weak one day becomes strong, and then they support. That's why we have community. So as we sing this song and as we respond, just ask God to reveal just where he's at, what he's doing in your life of faith this week.